Bill, I've been having
Yes.
Nancy read while you were gone because she loves to
Oh,
read too. I would like you to read. I don't know, Floyd, what do you think? Do we need, I guess because we have some people who haven't been here, we need to read Revelation 13.
whole thing?
What do you think we'll get through today?
No. We didn't get out of verse one last week, but
No. That's not to say we stayed in verse one.
no, we bounced around quite a bit. Just for everybody's information, the format we started following is when we start a chapter, we spend usually a week doing a preview. We read the whole chapter and then just try to talk about generically the whole thing. And then after that, we'll spend each week going, boring holes, great detail, verse by verse or whatever. And then when we get to the end of the chapter, then we spend time doing a review to sort of recap everything and connect the dots and that kind of thing. So that's the we did a preview of chapter 13 2 weeks ago, and then last week we tackled verse one. And as usual, I was like the anchor dredging across the bottom, digging up all kinds of stuff. So tends to slow it all down.
So maybe if you could read verses one, actually verse 18 from chapter 12.
So just before you do that, if I can introduce my wife, Irma.
Yes, please do.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
That's Irma with an I. It's not
Yes.
Irma.
Yes, I'm familiar with that name. Thank you for being here, Irma.
Thank you that I can join.
So, Jonathan has 12:18. Some versions place the first line of verse one in the following chapter here. So he starts with, "And the dragon stood on the seashore," as verse
Yes.
one.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I just want to make sure I'm in the right place.
Right. Yeah. So if you could read that verse until verse 10.
Through 10. Okay. Sure. Revelation 13, verses 1 through 10 from the Free Bible version. And the dragon stood on the seashore. Then I saw a beast rising out of the sea. He had 10 horns and 7 heads, and with 10 small crowns on his horns. He had blasphemous names on his heads. The beast I saw looked like a leopard, but his feet looked like those of a bear, and his mouth looked like that of a lion. The dragon gave the beast his power, his throne, and great authority. One of his heads seemed to have suffered a death blow, but this fatal wound had been healed. The whole world was filled with wonder at the beast, and they worshiped the dragon because he had given his authority to the beast. They worshiped the beast, asking, "Who is like the beast? Who could defeat him?" He was given the ability to make great boasts and speak blasphemies, and he was also given the authority to do this for 42 months. As soon as he opened his mouth, he spoke blasphemies against God, insulting his character, his sanctuary, and those who live in heaven. The beast was given power to attack believers and defeat them, and he was also given authority over every people, tribe, language, and nation. Everybody living on earth will worship him, those whose names had not been written in the book of life, the book of life that belongs to the Lamb slain from the beginning of the world. If you have ears, listen. Anyone who has to go into captivity will go into captivity. Anyone who has to die by the sword will die by the sword. This demonstrates the patient endurance and confidence in God of the believers.
I'd like to point out, starting out in verse 2, you have a composite beast, We're getting closer to Babylon. Babylon is not the beast, which I think Adventists have not made clear to, historically. But because of that, I'd like to give a little foreshadowing. Babylon loved mixtures. They had protective spirits who were like the fish man and the goat man and other composites like that. And there are other evidences of mixtures. They believed that life began by salt water and fresh water commingling together. But beyond that, we're talking Daniel here.
Hmm.
And the four beasts. So you have the leopard, the bear, the lion, lion's mouth, the roar. So you have these three creatures. What do they represent? Now, they're not quite the same as those in Daniel.
Just the residue of those beasts.
I think it's in Daniel 7 that I'm looking at. There were four beasts. There is a bear. We understand the bear with three ribs in its mouth between its teeth is supposed to be representing Medo-Persia. Because in order for Medo-Persia to become the powerful entity it was, it had to devour three other kingdoms. Then you have the leopard. On its back were four wings like a bird. This beast had four heads. Greece. Because Greece divided from Alexander the Great, divided into four entities. There were four generals that took over Alexander the Great's place. And then you have a nondescript beast that is just hideous. You don't have a lion. And the thing that comes to my mind when I think of lion is the lion of the tribe of Judah, but that mm-hmm. refers to Jesus. So that doesn't work there. Or you could take the text in Paul that Satan roamed the earth as a roaring lion, seeking whom he can devour.
For every true, there's a counterfeit.
And it's the mouth of the lion, not the whole thing in this.
It is the mouth of the lion. The roar. And the roar of a lion, I believe, is intended to freeze his prey so that he can catch it more easily.
Terror tactic.
Yeah. So the thing that to me seems interesting is that the beast coming up out of the sea is built on the past kingdoms. Well, how does that help us at all? Is there something that we can gain from that?
You know, that makes sense that it comes out of the sea.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as I said, I've been studying the sea for about 3 weeks now. And Ian helped me sort of distinguish the sea from the other waters, you know, the salt and salty water versus the fresh water, which helped really unpack a lot of what I was looking at. So if this creature, this composite creature of all these various kingdoms and their techniques and their attitudes and their dispositions, it's like history is reinventing itself. It's a conglomerate of history, and history is made up of peoples, which is the seas.
Is it possible that it is coming to its final culmination?
Yeah, I think so. It's like the epitome of the successful tactics that were refined and developed by previous empires that now turns into a conglomerate empire, a world empire of the very last, you know, attempt for Satan to take over the whole planet through all these various ways of intimidating and fear.
Mm-hmm. Bill.
Well, I was just thinking, in terms of my natural inclination, given how I was raised, was to try and identify nations, unions, etc. Mm-hmm. And I find that personally today problematic, but it's still my knee-jerk inclination. And so when I'm where I tried to go today is the character of those who oppose God. And Floyd mentioned the word that I tend to go to is empire oriented. Mm-hmm. And that describes almost every nation on earth, given its the ability to do it, would dominate others.
Well, yeah, I think this is the culmination of starting with one person ruling over others, which is the most basic form of a loss of freedom and individuality and autonomy, to a chieftain, to a king, to an emperor.
Who self-styles themselves as a god.
Yeah, ultimately takes over. Even if they don't style themselves as gods, they act like they're gods. Mm-hmm. And so I see this as this composite creature is a composite kingdom, because beasts do represent kingdoms mm-hmm. in the Old Testament. And it's a composite kingdom.
Of all of these.
Of everything.
Negative or whatever attributes that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what is interesting is its heads have blasphemous names.
All of them.
Yeah. All seven of them. Isn't it seven?
Seven or ten.
I hadn't noticed that till he read it this time. And I thought, wait, I've always just imagined like one of them. I suppose because in Daniel, it was one horn that had, you know, a blasphemy, but this one says all the heads. I'm like, oh, that's interesting.
And on its heads were blasphemous names.
Mm. Yeah.
Name in the Bible denotes character. So all of these heads present the direct opposite of the nature of God's kingdom. Maybe the extreme opposite of the nature of God's kingdom. And what does it mean that the dragon gave its throne? I've lost my place.
Verse 2, to the dragon gave the beast power, his throne, and great authority.
And great authority. What does that mean? Does Satan give away his authority?
Well, it doesn't sound like he gives away his authority, but he gives great authority.
His authority is hierarchical, not bottom up like God's authority. So in his system, well, I view Satan's entire system just like a pyramid scheme, a Ponzi scheme. And he is at the head. He started the whole thing, and he empowers those under him to do what he does.
Okay, so it's more of a shared power than
yes.
It is a total giving away.
No, he's not giving it away. He's authorizing them to and training them to do what he does best.
Yeah.
So I've heard a couple of descriptions, and one is a kind of power that sits as an absolute possession. And then if you are, let's say that's a king or a president or whatever, and if you've been appointed by that individual, you, for the slice of authority you have mm-hmm. as a cabinet member or whatever, as a slice, you speak with the authority of your boss.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That could be it.
And then I would say the God way is you so share character, he's not telling you what you should or shouldn't do or what you should or shouldn't say, but you're so aligned in character that there's no strings attached, no recriminations. It's his power grows because you're living into his creative power that you were designed to have and to exercise, which is entirely different.
I totally agree that God's power is always creative power, creation based power. It is never control. And so God empowers, and all of his commands are promises of empowerment. So
to accomplish what he does, his agenda. Yeah,
exactly. So I think of the one, a command Jesus gave that he prefaced with his authority when he said, "All authority is given me in heaven and in earth. Go therefore and teach all nations."
And then also in John 13, knowing that he has all this power.
Right.
And authority.
And authority. Then he uses that and demonstrates that authority by serving.
Yep.
Right. Yep. Serving the lowest level of service.
Serving the one who's about to betray him.
Yeah.
Knowing full well he's going to betray him. And loving him to the point of he almost repents.
But there's one thing we need to bring to the picture, and that is the fact that foot washing was considered the most degrading thing a person could do. It was something that was delegated to women, not even to servants.
So it truly was repulsive for them to have their
feet. It was repulsive. I read in Insight magazine. I think most of you are familiar with Insight magazine, even though it's dead and gone. But in Insight magazine, there was a very powerful story by John Dibdall. And if you know John Dibdall, he was a missionary for years in Thailand. And there was an artist that came to him and said that he wanted to paint a mural in a certain location that was very public that would depict all the religions of the world. And one of them would be Christianity. And he wanted Dibdall to tell him what the essence was of Christianity. And so he told him about the cross. And the man said, "Well, we have our dying and rising gods too. I mean, that's not a unique feature. I need a unique thing about Christianity." And John Dibdall thought, "What can I tell him?" And then he remembered Jesus washing his disciples' feet. So he told them the story. He was amazed because he knew in Thai culture, the feet were just obscene. You did not even talk about feet. In fact, he had a student. He was teaching English as a second language. And he had a student who came to him one day. She had been absent from class, and he asked her what was wrong. And she said, and she kept stuttering and stammering and talking all about it, but not talking about what it was. And finally it came out that it was her feet. She had a foot problem, but she couldn't talk about it. And so this artist said, "You mean to tell me that the founder of this religion, the God that you worship, knelt down and washed his disciples' feet?" And John said, "Yes." And he thought a moment and he said, "Then I will paint this picture on my mural." It was a story that was just unforgettable. It was so powerful in really getting across the culture of Jesus' day and what Jesus did.
Well, you remember what happened with the Good News Tour in Oregon.
You had a poster with that, didn't you?
They had a huge banner, and they had, all the leaders of the world with all their flags, like at the UN.
Oh, I remember that. I saw that.
And then they had Jesus washing the feet of Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so enraging to the Christians in the city that they banded together and forced them to remove their advertising and canceled their venue and everything. They were incensed at such a thing. And I was shocked when I heard the story. I was like, "You're kidding. You mean Christians don't believe this?"
No. Well, if you study Hitler's Germany, You might want to look into this. I don't think it's available on YouTube. You'd have to buy it, but you could always try. Maybe Bill can look it up for us. It's called Theologians Under Hitler. During the years before Hitler's Germany, there were three or four theologians who revised Jesus. And Jesus became a national hero, someone who didn't look anything like the Jesus of the Gospels. That's what's happened in America.
It's weaponized.
He's been completely recreated into a Caucasian male dominating force. And that's Christian nationalism that now exists in America.
It's so, the beast version of God.
Yep. So I want to just look at a little bit more at these blasphemous names. What do you think of when you think of blasphemous?
Well, the first thing is taking the name of the Lord in vain. However, it would be misrepresenting the character is where I would say today more than it is just profaning a name.
Yeah, it's profaning isn't as strong as blasphemy.
You know, they accused Jesus of blasphemy against God. And it occurred to me some time ago that they were right. They were accurate in their assessment. The things Jesus was saying and doing was blasphemy against their version of God. So they were speaking the truth. The problem was their God. Because Jesus' version of God so contradicted their sacred view of God that they were enraged, and their version of God was violated and desecrated, just like burning the Quran or something, you know? And it was just beyond the pale.
So transfer that to the blasphemous heads. These are heads that have the thinking and provide the action, basis for action, that is so totally contrary to who God is.
So this is what I...
They're in a complete opposition, but they claim to be speaking for God or being God.
And this is where I forget where the text, and I may be mixing a couple up, but Jesus, it's in the Gospels. You can say whatever you want against the Father, you can speak against the Son, but the one who speaks against the Spirit, right, can't be, there's nothing to be done for them. So to me, this level of blaspheme that we're getting in Revelation is because they may be professing in the name of God, in the name of a Christian God or whatever, maybe it's a bunch, but it's so contrary to the spirit of who God is that it's, they can use the name of God, they can use the name of Jesus, but it's not in his character, it's not in his spirit, it's not what the fruit produces. That to me is the level of blasphemy.
And it is extreme. It's at the extreme level. So it's very, very clear.
Now, I think it's helpful to keep in mind, especially in this chapter, that the symbols being used are the way heaven sees things. They are not the way they're going to appear to us. So when it describes these beasts, the actual entity or whatever it is that these beasts symbolize are to most people, they're not going to look like a beast. They're going to look very normal, very healthy, very powerful, very compelling, but they won't say, well, that's the beast. It's not identified that way. Just like in chapter 5, you know, when we talk about the Son of God, the Son of Man, the Lamb of God, we don't connect it to the symbol. I mean, we say, yeah, it's the lamb, but it's the violently slaughtered lamb with all the implications that go with that, which is the polar opposite of this beast.
Mm-hmm.
And, mm-hmm. But when you look at it, you don't see a lamb. You see a man. You see, well, whatever version of God that we think Jesus represented. And so these symbols are conveying very important things that will not appear obvious on the surface in what we call real life.
Thank you, Floyd, for telling this, because you just helped me with my paper. One of the questions I have to deal with, okay, so for those of you who don't know what I'm working on, we have an Adventist Society for Religious Studies that meets in November, and I've been accepted to give a paper, and the topic is on the cosmic conflict. And there's been some accusations by Adventists, one, a retired pastor, but by Adventists in the past and in the present, that this this teaching is not biblical. And so I compiled a list of what those accusations were. And the last one is a new one. The one most recently thrown is a new one. It is that the places in the Bible, in the Old Testament particularly, that talk about a cosmic conflict that we have used for that, like Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, for example, are myths. And immediately, you know, in Adventist thinking, that means they're bad. And of course, they're using myth in the wrong way. Mm-hmm. The academic definition of a myth is a theological story that explains a truth, and it may be true or it may not be. But the way they're using myth is, a myth is something that's just categorically not true. But what you helped me with is to realize the function of a myth is to tell things they can't tell openly.
That's how I've studied this whole book. When I began this study several years ago, and I didn't really know how to study it differently than how I was trained to, and the very first verse, I felt, contained two keys that, if used consistently throughout the entire book, would unlock things that couldn't see it before. And the first one was, whatever interpretation you propose cannot in the slightest deviate from a God who looks exactly like Jesus portrayed him to be, the revelation of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And that one's pretty obvious, although it's not obvious to a lot of people, but that one's pretty easy. The other one is not so obvious, but it's still, I found it highly effective. And that is, the entire book is a book of symbols.
Mm-hmm.
And because we have ignored that, and we've gone through and made arbitrary determinations that, oh, well, this is literal, but that's symbolic, and this is this. And it's like, who gets to choose? Who do we give authority to decide what's literal and what's not literal? Guess what? Consider it all symbolic. Try that for a change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that doesn't preclude that it may also include possibly literal, but I've noticed that as soon as we decide something's literal, that's it. We stop studying it. We don't look at anything else. We go on. And we might have missed the most important point because it was a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And symbols have to be explored and expanded and examined and say, well, what is it about the symbol? What are the characteristics of the symbol that can inform me about the spiritual reality it's trying to tell me about? Mm-hmm. And as I did that, suddenly, all kinds of stuff started falling into place and things started making sense. And even the Old Testament began working, you know, with this.
I don't deny that, for example, Isaiah 14, where the background of it is a myth. Mm-hmm. I don't deny that. But it's not really telling a myth as much as it is using mythopoeic language to describe something. And again, the function of a myth is very important. So that's one of the things I'm working on. Bill, you had something you wanted to say.
Oh, well, there goes the assumptions we make about interpreting the Bible. How literal is it? How inspired is it? In what ways is it inspired? As you know, so all of those things end up on an individual level and then on an organizational level influencing. But if you, for Adventists, we take a God-breathed, generally speaking, approach. And yet, when we talk about so much, it's absolutely interpreted a certain way, as opposed to being a narrative strung together by a bunch of people over thousands of years, with God meeting them where they were in ways that they could understand and relate to. And instead of holding it more loosely and wrestling with what it means historically, contextually, and now to me. So I it seems like sometimes we're, and I can speak to sometimes it's too much work. Now, I happen to enjoy this aspect of it, so for me that's become less of an issue, but it's just a simple reading of the Bible. And every time I hear that, I'm like, I've never encountered a simple reading of the Bible. I just have more questions. And the more I live, the more questions I have. And yet the simple reading is, you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where I end up starting and trying to understand. But I'm in a group on one of the social media platforms, and there are people who are now atheist and angry. And the only way they can read the Bible is sort of this lockstep, everything is absolutely dictated. And all I can ask, and they'll come, you know, I can ask, why do you read it that way? You're an atheist. Can't you find another way to read it that might make it poetic or historic or anything? Then, you know, but they can't make that adjustment. It's so deeply ingrained.
Yeah, because, and this is what I learned from a professor I had at Berkeley. I got my doctorate at Berkeley, which is one of the most liberal higher educational institutions in the nation. And this was a moderately liberal professor, given what I know about other professors. I ran into this with him, that his bias was verbal inspiration, God is angry, etc., etc. And everything he did was a reaction to that. It was foundational. And one of the greatest illustrations of that was in 1991. There was a terrible earthquake in Oakland, and fires broke out, and a lot of poverty-stricken people lost their homes. His home was affected because of everything was contaminated by this earthquake, and he had to leave his home. He could no longer live there. And so we had to miss class one evening. When I came back to class, I had to miss another night, or another day rather, because my car failed me. And when I came back to class, we were in Hosea. And oh, God was so angry. He was the kind that would soften the wrath of God. He would not talk of it in ways that was really strong and virulent. But now God was angry. And I realized how close he was really to the thing that he was most opposed to. And it was a very personal thing. As I got to know him through the years of having to deal with him. Well, we got a little bit off topic, but that's not a bad thing.
There was something that came to mind while Bill was reading that it never occurred to me before, which is not unusual. When he talked about one of the heads, was it one of the heads?
One of the heads received a death blow.
Yes. And recovered. And I, again, if you think of it literally, obviously it's a symbol, but the symbols have to be taken literally to make sense out of them. What would a death blow look like to a head?
I think they saw death blows quite frequently in battle.
And so it would be like a cracked skull.
Mm-hmm.
It would certainly leave.
Head.
It would leave a scar, wouldn't it?
It would leave the head that was no longer able to be discerned improperly. I mean, let's see.
Well, if it recovered, had to be enough of the head left to recover, I guess. But
my version says one of its heads appeared to be slain and killed, but its deadly wound was healed. Hmm. This would be a head that got probably a mace taken to it. Because that's one of the ways in which they slaughtered in battle anciently. And it killed him. Because if you deliver a mace blow to a head hard enough, it's going to kill the beast.
If it recovered, which it says it did, wouldn't there be a scar?
Well, it depends on how fully it recovered. If it had miraculous intervention, it could look as though nothing ever happened to it.
But then it wouldn't look like it had received a deadly wound.
Well, so
unless this is a story, and you see first the deadly wound and then you see the healing.
I can see it work in a few different ways, because if we're talking a nation state or something like that, there could be scars from war and it's been repaired, but that history is carried on.
Mm-hmm. Now that leaves mental scars among people.
Oh, post-traumatic stress, on many sides, really.
Right. What were registered for me was if this beast has this obvious scar that raises, that alerts you that something has happened, and you'll never forget it because you see the scar in your face, and this beast is really, really intimidating and powerful. Would that scar be the mark that shows up later? In other words, everyone now has to look like the beast along with the damage to him to be counted as identifying with him in order to avoid all the recriminations that are going to happen if you don't.
I would put it more as character, although mm-hmm. I suppose a tattoo is not ruled out, something to that effect. I can envision any number of different countries through history that have been abused or an abuser.
Mm-hmm.
And let's just pick one, without naming it. So, and it's like, okay, so if that is the one that looked like it had been America nukes Japan, and Japan has this death blow. And I'm not saying that this is part what Revelation is saying. It's just one that comes to my mind. And now it's vibrant, it's going. So do we have tattoos or something of Hiroshima and an atomic weapon, or is it an attitude of the emperor prior to that, or is it the attitude of America for doing it? Is it the, so mm-hmm. I think this is, I take it, again, I tend to be abstract. I am not as literal as many. I don't need it, but I do see it as literally character and the actions that flow from our character.
Okay. Can I use the model of abuse?
Okay.
A great kingdom that abuses people comes to some kind of terrible end that leaves scars. But he is healed because he no longer abuses people. At least it appears that he no longer abuses people. And all that ugly past that is tied to this beast, this kingdom, no longer is effective. But it's still there. To those who know, who have done their history, does that work at all?
And if he now accomplishes the same means, but far more subtly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah.
So he's still abusing, but it doesn't appear like abuse anymore.
Exactly. Because everybody agrees with it.
Because everybody has learned to think and act just like it to get along and be part of the team.
However, there would still be abuse to those who...
Who don't.
Who don't. To those who refuse the mark.
And the amazing thing to me is, how does that... Let's assume, at least in my mind, these are people from whom love flows. And they live as grace personified by this time. Even if they're not, quotes, perfect, but it's just this flow of the fruit of the Spirit. And these are the ones called evil mm-hmm. in their day. Is that, mm-hmm. I mean, that's sort of how I'm picturing the scenario at this stage in the story.
Mm-hmm.
Because evil is defined now as uncooperative.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, and if you're uncooperative, you're divisive and you're destroying the unity and the harmony of society. Therefore, you are the problem
mm-hmm.
that has to be either dealt with or exterminated. Because until unity is achieved, law and order in society is going to be threatened.
Well, that's the way of control in the adversary's camp.
So before we get too far moving forward, I'd like to back up a little bit just to make one point. I've made this point before, but I think I see it a little more broadly. We talked about the heads, the blasphemous heads, the blasphemous character of the beast. What's the opposite of that in Revelation?
The lamb slain?
Well, ultimately, maybe, but there's actually a direct opposite in chapter 12. In chapter 13, it says, verse 4, they worship the dragon because they've been given the beast its authority. They worshiped the beast and said, who is like the beast?
Mm, okay.
And who can fight against it?
With Michael.
That is the direct opposite of Michael, mm-hmm. who is like God. That's the name of Michael. Michael, who is like God. And that's always a question. And it's kind of a dramatic opposite because the name of Michael is not a settled, this is like God. It's like, who is like God? You have a choice. Are you going to worship the beast or are you going to worship Michael? And it's not dogmatic at all. I just wanted to point that out.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, I think the whole war is over who we identify with. Because when you identify with someone that you admire, you want to be like, you become like them. That's the principle of worship, is you become like what you admire, even if what you admire is what you hate and you despise, but you're fixated on it because it's riveted your imagination, you can't tear yourself away from it. That's actually a weird form of worship. It really is. I mean, it's like being addicted to horror movies and stuff. It affects your capacity to receive and give love.
That kind of worship is really addiction.
Well, addiction is, I think, a form of worship.
It's a false form.
Yeah, yeah. But it's the principle of worship. It's not, well, I mean, you either worship the beast or you worship God. Yeah. And the false worship is you worship out of fear or lust or whatever. Whereas true worship is you appreciate and admire the freedom and the character. Yeah. I mean, even the kinds of worship are opposite.
I have long thought that Satan has prepared the world for his entree into claiming to be Christ with the movies.
Oh, yeah.
That are watched.
Yeah.
That he's prepared us for violence. He's prepared us for. And there have been studies that have done that link movies with violence in America.
The entertainment, the social media, the
mm-hmm.
movie industry, the music industry, mm-hmm. they all play a major role in conditioning our perception of reality and what's normal.
So I'm going to be a fly in the ointment.
You better get out of that ointment or you're going to drown.
I know. Now, I can see the two sides at work everywhere. So I hesitate. I mean, come on. My first career was Hollywood film and television industry. And there's plenty of evil, but there is also plenty of good. And I will tell you again and again, what is made is what will sell.
Mm-hmm.
You want to change what is made, you change the hearts of the viewers and receivers and consumers.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's on the consumer to choose what they wish. And when you, it's a mirror. So the producers are mirroring what there's a mutual influence perhaps, but I have met God in music and in movies, and I get to see the great controversy played out in art. So I can't add my voice to a blanket statement.
I know it sounds like a blanket statement, and I can understand how that can trigger, but I do think that there is, you're right, it does depend heavily, because it's commercial, on what goes, but they also will push the edges in the direction they want to go, because watching or listening or whatever it is, participating in these things, those things now shape you and condition you to want more of the same with a little stronger. So it's going both ways, you know, not only, and I'm not saying everything is evil. I mean, God really has challenged me on that. However, that doesn't mean I should go out and watch anything and everything.
Not everything, you know, is beneficial. Not everything builds
right up.
And
yet God can use some of the most, I mean, I met a friend years ago with what I didn't know her at the time. But she was sharing her story. She had grown up not Christian, not knowing anything about God, absolutely nothing. Never read the Bible, didn't know anything, never heard of Jesus. And she went to the Broadway musical Jesus Christ Superstar. You know, entertainment, right? She went to see it, loved it. And her curiosity got up and said, who is this Jesus they're talking about? I never heard of him, you know? Got a Bible, started reading, became an Adventist. And I'm listening to her story and I'm going, God, what? What? You did what? You used that? I couldn't deny it. I mean, it was her story, right? And God's like, be careful. That doesn't make Jesus Christ Superstar something I should go watch.
Right.
But he used it to get her curiosity up and put her onto a track. And she became a Bible worker. And I'm like, wow, God's pretty amazing.
You know, I heard a not unsimilar story by a man who was heavy into drugs and the whole lifestyle of the rock culture of the 70s. And he put on a record, a rock record, a heavy, heavy metal rock record that was about Jesus, as I recall. And the needle got stuck on one thing, that Jesus loves you. And it went round and round and round and round. This is back in the days of the vinyl records, you know. And it just kept saying this over and over and over again, because he was on a trip. I mean, he was out of it. And when it was over, he decided to accept Jesus. It's an amazing story.
There are the Spirit of God and the Spirit of the adversary are at work everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And as much as I would love to say it's settled in my mind, I sense the conflict continually. And it's daily choices and other things. And there are things that I don't see today that I would have before. And there's things I would see today that I'm much more comfortable than I was before. And there's no rhyme or reason. And that which I'm comfortable with, another person could find to be highly problematic. And I think that is where how we are in our relationships with God, and why I think the freedom I have to eat whatever, you know, as a metaphor for anything, isn't to be flaunted to another, but at the same time, my concern of what that freedom is, I have to be careful that I don't diminish the experience of another. And so I will say, I know high quality spirit-led people in the arts and in all forms, from the organization to the, and there's also plenty of those who aren't, but I see that in the church as well. So I if I'm going to diss an artist industry, I'm going to diss religion. I have to include it. Anyway, that's my two cents.
The heart condition is the most important thing.
And so I think we need to encourage each other not, you know, how do we do that and how do we lower the barriers to receiving the Spirit? And it may or may not be forms of art and the consumption of certain forms of art. It may be that, but it might not be that. What are the things in a person's journey? And why, to me, when I'm looking at Revelation 13, it's perhaps less a literal nation or a literal state or it may be, right? But it's the spirit of the adversary and it's the spirit of the Lamb and having discernment, mm-hmm. I guess.
And you just gave the answer to Michael's name. The one who is like God is the Lamb.
Mm-hmm. If I can chip in and ask a few questions and make a couple of comments. Gene, I was intrigued by your statement that Babylon is not the beast. Why would you say that?
Babylon rides the beast. If you look further in Revelation
17.
So even the title that the editors of my Bible say is Babylon and the Beast. At chapter 17, Then he brought me in a spirit-inspired trance to a desert. There I saw a woman seated on a scarlet beast. And the name of the woman was written on her forehead, Babylon the Great. She's sitting on the beast. Mm-hmm. She's not the beast.
Here's the problem. We're in traditional Adventism, the head that regains its health and life is seen as being Catholicism. But I would put Catholicism under Babylon.
I know.
And is that why you're making the distinction? I mean, it's obvious that Babylon's riding the beast and guiding the beast, but we don't seem to run that through consistently in our interpretation of this.
No, I believe Ellen White's statement that if Adventists would study the Book of Revelation more fully, more completely, that there would be a revival. And I don't think she was meaning that we'd just go over our Revelation seminar notes. I believe that she meant that we would see fresh insights, fresh meaning. Adventists have never studied Revelation theologically. Politically, yes. Religiously, yes. But never theologically. I think I've said this here before, but I'll say it again. When I was finishing college at Andrews University, I went to check out the MA in religion because I was thinking of taking it. And I told the woman who was in charge of that MA that I wanted to study Revelation from a thematic perspective. And she said, well, you better ask God about that. And I decided that that would not be what I studied, and that would not be where I studied it.
So can I put you on the spot and ask you how you interpret the beast with a fatal wound that's healed?
Historically, you mean historic, using the historical method that Adventists traditionally use? The beast whose wound is healed, I think, is quite evident. That's, I would say, historically, that's Roman Catholicism. Babylon rides the beast. I'll be radical. In John's day, I believe he saw Babylon as old Jerusalem, because in the lineup of pairs of opposites, the mark versus the seal, the Michael versus the beast, and on and on. That lineup is such that John sees the new Jerusalem as the new Jerusalem in heaven, coming down from heaven. Babylon as the old Jerusalem that had fallen. So if you were to take that as the template that John is seeing, Babylon would be any entity that falls to the beast, uses its methods, controls people like it, and so on. And that has yet to be revealed. It could be apostate Protestantism. Could be apostate evangelical Christianity. Could be national Christian. Could be in any number of those things. But that's how I see it in John's day. And that's the template I use for deciding what the future holds.
So it feels like to me you're mixing Babylon and the beast.
Actually, the other way feels that way to me. If Babylon and the beast are the same, you're mixing them together.
Well, that's the problem I see with identifying Catholicism as the beast.
How do you identify the beast?
I have, but I'm not prepared to be put on the spot.
Okay, I there's an option. There's an option, Ian. It could be Rome. and then Babylon would fit as Catholicism.
So the dragon is the adversary.
Right.
The beast that rises is what we're saying is the question.
It's a kingdom, yeah. Okay. All beasts in the Bible are kingdoms.
But so the one who has their, this is seven heads on a single beast, right?
Mm-hmm.
And only one of them had damage, isn't it?
Right.
So worse, to me, there's a, I struggle again, Ian, or all of us, with identifying and saying it has to be a certain one thing. If to me the beast is a systematic approach of abuse, and the heads might be a variety of
manifestations of it.
Yeah, manifestations is the good word, I think, of it, through time or commingling in time even. Or both. And I'm curious, with understanding it here, Babylon being Old Jerusalem, and what that meant to John in seeing this future vision.
The reason I think that way, and I haven't, this is a tentative conclusion, okay? So this is not set in cement by any means. I may have to change my mind down the road, because I've only started to study this, and I have a long ways to go before I'm ready to really delve into it completely. But there is a viewpoint in New Testament scholarship. It's fielded by one person who has studied intertestamental literature and has concluded that the Jews in the Gospel of John are the Jews that came back from Babylon and carried Babylon ideology and Babylonian theology with them and imposed it on the Jews, on the maybe you should say the tribe of Judah. You know, the name Jews, I believe, is the name that the Babylonians called them. And this is a peculiar thing in John's gospel. They would refer to them as the Jews, as though it's a derogatory term. But it would fit if Babylon did, and this is something I need to verify, if Babylon is the one who named them Jews, they would be the ones coming back from Babylon who carried certain views with them. And I've been studying the influences of Babylon on Judaism. The Sanhedrin is a Babylonian product. It resembles the Kanishtu, the circle of priests in Babylon. Caiaphas' use of the oath on the trial of Jesus is Babylonian. I would have to explain that at length, but I don't want to do that here until we get to Babylon. Yep. So there's just things, and there are things, and I guess I'm seeing that John in his day, even though he knew this was future, he still saw contemporary meaning. And there are other elements in here. When I read about Babylon, in chapter 18, I can see how it fits with the rejection of Jesus by the Jews. For example, in chapter 18, you have the kings of the earth who committed sexual immorality with her. Early Adventists saw that as the union of church and state, and they were right. Well, if Jerusalem is Babylon, but Jerusalem rode the beast of Rome to get Jesus crucified. That's no problem. I mean, it's not something really that is not obvious. But there's a list of items, economic items, merchants who sold these things and got rich, and the great city that wore fine linen. Fine linen is a priestly kind of garment, glittered with gold, jewels, and pearls. There was cargoes of gold, silver, jewels, and pearls, fine linen, purple, silk, scarlet, all these things are made of scented wood, ivory, fine wood, bronze, iron, marble, cinnamon, incense, fragrant ointment, frankincense, wine, oil, fine flour, wheat, cattle, sheep, carriage, and slaves. That is human lives. In Babylon, and this could mean literal slaves, but in Babylon, it was very the hallmark of their religion that they were created to be slaves of the gods. And that's why they did their temple worship. They did it as slaves. They would not eat with the god. They would give him offerings. They would worship him. They would appease him, mostly appease him, and try to make him happy so he wouldn't hurt them. And so you have this kind of portrayal. When Caiaphas says, and I'm kind of jumping around here because I'm doing this off the top of my head, and I haven't written those chapters yet. But Caiaphas says, it is better that one man die than the whole nation perish. That is a thought, an ideology right out of the Sharkpukhi ritual in Babylon. In Assyro-Babylon. It was done in Assyria. It was done in Babylon. The Sharkpukhi ritual occurred when the omens lined up that the king was in trouble with the gods. The gods were angry with the king. They were going to let him get killed in battle or some other catastrophe. It was better that the king die than that the whole nation perish. And so they did a Sharkpukhi ritual. Sharkpukhi is substitute king ritual. They brought in a commoner or anybody that they decided would be king for 40 days, 100 days, whatever they specified. At the end of those, and the real king went off somewhere and stayed away. At the end of those days, they had a banquet. They reinstalled the real king and the substitute king and queen. They took out and executed them. Therefore, the gods had put to death the king. So when Caiaphas says, it is better that one man die, the whole nation perish. That's right out of Babylon. So I haven't proved this yet. This is a tentative belief on my part. But I think there's going to be enough evidence to support the conclusion that Babylon killed Jesus. I realize that sin actually ultimately took his death, but I'm using that because if sin hadn't, Babylon would have killed Jesus.
Interesting. Thank you. If I can just make the connection about the first beast in chapter 13 comes out of the sea and the second one comes out of the land. And the beasts in Daniel 7 all come out of the turbulent sea and they come out by violence. And so that fits that the sea is ever moving tides and waves and so on. Is that nations that come out of the sea arise out of violence. And then the beast that comes out of the land comes, originates in peace. And it's a non-violent origin.
If you're going to use a historical view, that fits very well with our belief that it pertains to the United States, the rise of the United States.
Yes.
I have no trouble with the historical view, except because it seems to combine the beast and Babylon. I have no trouble. I'm simply trying to move into the text as John saw it and see the light that we have from it as another way of of getting to the theology of Revelation.
So as a non-American, you'll forgive me for saying that the claim that America arose peacefully is really stretching the limits of credulity. If you ask the indigenous people,
that's true,
and you ask the Mexicans, and you ask the British, and you ask the French, none of them would say America rose peacefully.
That's true. I agree with you.
One other question I wanted to ask was, you said that Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28 are mythical stories. I'm not sure if you said they were alleged to be mythical stories. Why not call them parables?
I'm going to compare, because in Old Testament, I'm an Old Testament person, and scholars in Old Testament would never call them parables. That belongs to the New Testament language. They would call them myths. But myths are like parables. And I'm going to use that argument in my paper.
It's just that in normal usage, when you say, oh, that's a myth, you mean it's not true.
Right. I know. And that's in common interpretation of the word, but the word as defined, the first meaning of the word in most dictionaries has it that it can be true. I have a very helpful book called The Myth of Cosmic Rebellion. And the person using it has gone back into Ugaritic, which is Canaanite myths, and discovered a kind of motif of a mythic rebellion. And he uses that to show that Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 14 are legitimate stories of mythic rebellion. And I have, when I've had students in Hebrew exegesis do papers, one of the choices they have is a paper on Ezekiel 28. And I have them use that book. And they found it very helpful to support an Adventist view of a cosmic rebellion.
So it seems quite well accepted by scholars that Isaiah 14 and 28 are explanations, myths, whatever you want to call them, about the origin of evil in the cosmos. How did that get started?
Actually, most scholars reject that.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you saying that Adventists came up with it themselves?
It's hard to know. My sense of things, and I'm not a church historian, but my sense of things from other things I've seen in Adventist history is that this was a fairly common view among certain evangelicals in the 1800s. I haven't proved that. Let me tell you a little bit about my history on this. I took a class in research methods at La Sierra University when I was getting my master's at Loma Linda University. Loma Linda at that time comprised both Loma Linda and La Sierra. And I decided to write a paper that I had been wanting to write on Ellen White and the cosmic conflict. And my teacher had a fit. He said, she just borrowed all that. He said, you're too Maxwellian. You shouldn't follow Maxwell. She just borrowed all that from Milton and other writers. And he gave me a list of books that I had to use. This is by the way, unethical in academic circles. You're never supposed to tell a person what they're supposed to use for their sources. But anyway, he gave me this list of books. I went down to the Lasier University Library. It wasn't Lasier University at the time, Lasier Campus Library. And I checked out all the books, took them home, began to read them. And I went, well, I can use this. I can use that. Yeah, I don't have a problem with this. But what these authors haven't said is that Ellen White used the cosmic conflict in a way that nobody else ever had. And that is to make clear the issues in the cosmic conflict over the character and government of God. So I used all the sources. I wrote my paper, and the teacher was sweating over it. He took forever to grade my paper. And he finally did, and I got an A. One of the papers, one of the books that I read, was written, I believe, by an English professor, where she did a study of all the treatments of cosmic conflict kinds of things by literature. Milton, some of the earlier literary people. And she pointed out, either it was her or another book that I used, she pointed out that originally the cosmic conflict was alive and well in Christianity. She didn't point out that Augustine started to go a different direction, and she didn't point out that Tertullian before Augustine went a different direction. But she pointed out that Calvin, by going to a legal construct for salvation, suffocated the cosmic conflict. And today's world in America, most churches except Roman Catholicism have gone Calvinist in orientation.
You mean via the penal substitution theory?
Yeah. That and some other things. Sovereignty of God. They may not have gone as far as predestination, but they're heavily into the sovereignty of God. And God, the reason for this and the reason for that is because God has to be sovereign.
And this is what we were talking about a little bit earlier, about where authority is derived from, whether it's hierarchical or bottom-up. And a good example of this is that we give the Bible the authority in our lives, but secular people don't, and Muslims don't, although they're not too bad on it. But we give no authority to the Quran in our lives. So that these sacred texts, their power and authority stems from the people who've given it to them. It's not a decree from somewhere else.
That's true. The problem has been that we've delved into dogmatics, and it isn't the Bible that we've given authority to. We've given authority to our dogmas.
Yeah. So I see that as the great difference between Babylon and I'm not sure what the opposite of Babylon is.
The opposite of Babylon is the New Jerusalem. See, there's...
All right.
Revelation has a seam in the middle of it called Revelation 12.
Okay, good.
And it's the war in heaven. Yeah. And in war, you have two sides. And you have those two sides spelled out in Revelation as the mark versus the seal, the lamb versus the beast, and all these pairs of opposites, including the old Jerusalem, or rather Babylon and New Jerusalem.
Yeah.
Those are the two cities.
And Paul says that Jerusalem is our mother. So it's about identification with a picture of God.
Mm-hmm.
You either have the beast version of God, which is inspired by Babylon, or you have the lamb version of God, which is all those who compose the New Jerusalem.
Yeah. So the authority of the Lamb is gained via his torture and death. And it's the slaughtered lamb that can open the seals.
Mm-hmm.
But in Babylon, it's the dragon that provides authority to the inhabitants.
So the lamb has authority because of his credibility.
Yeah.
The dragon gives authority through compliance and co-conspirators. If you cooperate with the spirit of the dragon, then he'll empower you to carry out his agenda, which is very different than the lamb trusting the followers to reflect him and still have complete freedom.
Yeah.
Could I add one link in that the dragon gives authority to the beast and the beast gives authority to Babylon?
Mm-hmm.
So it ultimately comes from the dragon, but there's an intermediary and that's the beast. Of course, has to do with my view of Babylon riding the beast.
So the really question in 17 is, who's in charge? You know, is the dragon that she's riding, is he leading her to believe beast? That she's, you know, it doesn't even say she controls him. She's just riding him. She's on it for the ride.
She rides the beast, not the dragon.
Okay, yeah, but it's the seven-headed.
It's a seven-headed beast, yes. But
yeah, which still, in our thinking, looks like a dragon. And it acts like one. They're very similar.
Yeah, the beast.
It's a dragon-infused beast.
Yeah, but it has a different name.
Right, you're right. So she's riding this dragon-looking-like beast, but is the beast in charge? And will the beast dispose of her once she fails or is of no longer worth? You know, like a prostitute, it's like, okay, once they're used up and there are no more benefit, then discard them. Because that's sort of what happens at the end there.
You know, Revelation 17 is one of the most difficult chapters in Revelation. What it talks about is the beast that you saw was and is and is about to come out of the abyss and go to destruction.
Everybody on that side is headed for destruction.
Right.
The last verse of chapter 17 says, "And this woman you saw in your vision represents the great city that rules over the kings of the world." And yet just a few verses back, apparently the kings of the world destroy her.
Mm-hmm. When you read the Bible, you're looking, Revelation is Hebraic. John, the Gospel of John is Hebraic. And in Hebraic thought, you can go back and forth in time, and that is not an issue. Hebrew thinking, and I was going to bring this up earlier, Hebraic thinking is dynamic, not temporal, and temporal, I should say. Greek thinking is static and spatial. So in Hebrew thinking, in a dynamic sphere, you can live with incongruities and incoherence. And you can live with lack of logic and other things that we think are so important in our Western culture. So I have to read the Bible through a Hebraic lens and not expect things to fit in a neat and tidy way that I can then use to control other people, which I'm afraid is what we Adventists have tended to do.
You said in Hebraic thinking, time is dynamic and temporal, while in Greek
thinking is dynamic and temporal.
And in Greek thinking, time is static. And what was the other characteristic?
In Greek thinking, their thinking is static and spatial, having to do with
okay, I got
something
it.
Fixed and something in place.
Yeah. Of course, having said that, you can get away with almost anything now.
No, what I can do is tolerate a lack of coherence and still believe it's true.
And over time, the clarity begins to emerge.
Yes.
And the details start to fill in. But I'm learning that by suspending, in other words, is my belief built on, can you prove it to me with enough logic and enough arguments before I'm willing to believe it? Or am I willing to believe it because it looks and acts and smells like Jesus, even if I can't explain it?
Mm-hmm.
Because when I slowly evolved into believing in a nonviolent God, which was a major block for me, it happened imperceptibly, literally, over a year or two, because as I had to question and suspend and leave open, because before that I was expecting all my questions about, what about Korah, Dathan, and Abiram? What about, this? What about that? What about Sodom and Gomorrah? If you can't explain those, then I can't believe it. And that's what I run into a lot. Whereas if I start by believing a Jesus-looking God and believe it beyond and having my questions answered, over time, my questions about those other stories have been answered fabulously, even logically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I don't base my belief on God because they now make sense to me. It helps. I have to base my belief in a nonviolent God on the Lamb,
mm-hmm.
who rather received violence without ever threatening it in return.
Mm-hmm.
That has to be the only safe foundation. And then everything else is going to have to fit that. And whether it ever does or not, cannot shake my faith.
Well, it sounds to me like you went from one cognitive structure to another, but I don't think you're saying that. I think when you say you base your belief on the slaughtered lamb, you're not swapping one cognitive view for another. There's something about a slaughtered lamb that's very emotional.
Yeah. So you are going from one paradigm to another. You're going from the Greek way of proving what's true, mm-hmm. to the Hebraic, more emotional. I'm nervous about using the word emotional because, I was conditioned for many years to never trust your emotions, especially when it comes to faith and belief. And now I'm having to backtrack on that and say, this emotionless religion I've had has not done a thing for me except made me miserable. Yeah. And I'm going to have to get in touch with my emotions. At the same time, however, I'm warned by the Spirit to not base my faith on what my emotions are saying. At the same time, however, if my emotions at some point are not confirming that my faith is real, I've got a question that my faith is real.
Could I spin that a little bit?
Yeah, it probably needs it.
Well, there's emotional intelligence and there's IQ intelligence, which would be cognitive intelligence. they are finding now in studies that they've done that a person who does not have emotional intelligence is less fully intelligent. That not having emotional intelligence diminishes intelligence. Because they don't have any breadth, they don't have any depth, in the sense of the whole person. That's another thing about Hebrew thinking. Hebrew thinking is holistic. Greek thinking is linear.
And often superficial.
And in a linear thinking, you can bisect any line of thought by another line of thought and negate it. And consequently, you go to philosophy, particularly philosophy of religion, where all they do is have these lines of thought, these logical lines of thought that other people come along, other philosophers come along and bisect and say, no, that's not true because this, if this is true, then this and this and so on. And I had to teach philosophy of religion 1 quarter and I said, never again. But in the process of teaching it, I finally realized that it's not working. It's just not working. Philosophy can't work without a larger panorama of what is happening, a holism, a holistic structure. In fact, I wouldn't call it a structure, a holistic way of looking at things.
A backstory.
Not just even a backstory, but something that involves the whole person and a holistic view of reality. The spin I would make, Floyd, is that you're looking for emotional intelligence, and without emotional intelligence, there is no ethics. There is no morality. And the frightening thing is that religion, by becoming so left brain, disengaged from the right brain, which is where emotional intelligence is, has created a moral chaos. Only it's rigid moral chaos. Because if, and this is what psychiatrists have really determined in brain science, that if the left brain gets detached from the right brain, you have rigidity. And if the right brain gets detached from the left brain, you have chaos. But if you have the right brain and the left brain working together, you have integration.
Stability.
No. Integration means everything's linked together in a perfect whole.
Well, I mean, but stable means that, well, you're not either.
Well, it does.
Not either in chaos or, yeah. Or locked.
Yeah, you are stable.
But it's like having two legs to walk, you know.
But that is, it's defined, it's not definitive. What's definitive is the holism.
Yeah.
The balance. I would call it balance.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Jean, could you just tell me again, if the left brain is dominant, what do we have?
Left brain is cut off from the right brain. We have rigidity.
Like dogmatic, arbitrary.
Yeah, thank you.
This is the newest wave of psychiatry and psychology is the brain science, that if we deal with the brain appropriately, we can help people with who have been in trauma or who have experienced trauma. It's a ways away from Freud.
So this chapter has, chapter, let me see, 13 has how many verses?
See, 18.
18. It's mm-hmm. taken 3 weeks to do verse one.
That's about my speed.
I don't care how long it takes, because the longer it takes, the easier it will be to do Babylon. Have more time to work on it.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. It's been very stimulating.
And as you noticed, I'm quite confrontational. But
that's all right.
It's done with good heart. And you've survived as a teacher for a long time, so you're not
special. I am good, used. You know, other women read papers that are the Adventist Society for Religious Studies, and they don't get any controversy. I read a paper, and it blows up. So I'm used to confrontation.
Yeah.
I think we are ready to go.
Yep.
So, why don't we have closing prayer? Father in heaven, we thank you for our discussion, for wrestling with texts that in a process that can help us to rethink how we see power, authority, and how we see you. Thank you for being the kind of God you are. One that we can love and trust freely, not because we're told to, but because you are trustworthy and love itself. May this always be the case with us. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
Amen.